Doll.
Hey, Doll.
I'm your host, Paula.
And I'm your host, Cynthia.
And we are
Dolls and Doom.
Hey, guys. Sorry we weren't around last week. I had a head cold, and I didn't want to get Cynthia sick because we record in person together. So thanks for hanging in there.
Yeah, absolutely. We missed you guys, but especially in the current climate, we're being extra precautious and careful.
That's right.
We're not tech savvy enough to know how to do this any other way than in person. So.
One day we'll learn.
Yeah. Or we'll hire someone.
There you go.
All right. Well, Paula, I'm going to do something a little different today.
Okay.
I think I'm always pretty honest and vulnerable, but today I'm going to like take that to a new level. Today's story is definitely a true crime case, but this time the victim isn't someone that I only know by name. Today's story is actually mine. Well, it's my husband's. Today I'm going to tell you the survival story of my husband, Andy. Okay, so I'm going to start by telling you that in today's case, I am going to actually use an alias for our perpetrator's name. Just because of the proximity, I definitely don't owe him that, but I feel like it's the right thing to do. So when I use the name Peter Simon, just know that's an alias. All right, a little backstory about my family. My husband's name is Andy. He joined the Marines at 17, began serving at 18, and he served in the Marines for 4 years. And during that time, he was deployed to Iraq, where he served in Operation Iraqi Freedom. And towards the end of his time as a Marine, he started experiencing some health problems that he later found out were due to some of the different things that he was exposed to during his time in service. So he was honorably discharged as a disabled veteran due to these health problems. Now, he's the kind of guy who he doesn't just sit around, so it's a good thing he was still able to work. When he came back to the States, he decided after a few years he didn't love the frigid Boston winters anymore. So he moved from Boston to Florida, where he decided he wanted to be a police officer. So he's been working as a police officer for a little over 10 years now. When I first met him, I asked him what made him want to become a law enforcement officer, and he said it was because he wanted to help people. And if you listeners knew my husband, you would know that he's just the sweetest guy. He's kind, he's a good guy all around, and he definitely just wants to help people. I met him in 2014. We met online, and when we met, he lived a little over an hour away from me, just a few minutes from the department where he worked. But within about 2 weeks of us dating, I bought my house, again, an hour away from his. And when we decided to get married the following year, we had to make a big decision about where we wanted to live. Because his house was so close to where he worked, we'd already decided I was going to have a couple of babies and stay home with them. Logistically, it did make sense for me to move to his house. And at the time, I had an 11-year-old son who was already established at a school. He had lots of friends, and my parents lived near me, so my husband didn't want to uproot him. So he decided to actually move to my house. So that means my husband now has a 3-hour round-trip commute every day. So he's up at 3:30 every morning. He drives for more than an hour to get to work. He works a 12-hour shift and then drives more than an hour to get home. If we're lucky, he walks in the door around 7 p.m. And he does this day after day.
That is so much driving.
It's so much driving. Goodness. And imagine being up at 3:30.
No, I can't.
Out the door by 4 a.m. and you walk in at 7 p.m. that night.
Oh my gosh.
Insane, right?
That's beyond insane.
And he's never once complained. Not once.
Wow.
You're probably like, what is this about, Cynthia? What are you talking about? But I wanted you to know about the distance between our home and his department, because it does kind of become relevant later in our story. So now you know just a brief little bit about my husband. Now I'm going to tell you about Peter Simon. So Peter was born in Parkersburg, West Virginia on September 1st, 1995. He moved to Florida with his parents and his grandparents in May of 1998. He went to a boarding school in Montana for 1 year before moving to East Amherst, New York. Then he became a father to a son, and he graduated from high school in 2014. After graduation, he worked as a cook and a roofer before moving back to Florida to be closer to his mother. On February 10th, 2018, a woman named McKenna Berger, and that's not her real name either. But McKenna went to a house party with Peter. Some sources say that she was his longtime girlfriend, and other sources make it seem like this was maybe just, you know, a casual date. So I don't really know, but I actually lean towards them having a long-term relationship. That's what I believe to be probably the more accurate scenario. But at some point during the night, 22-year-old Peter asked McKenna if she would take a ride with him so that they could go someplace where they could be alone. And McKenna later told the police that Peter was really drunk, so she told him she didn't want to get in the car with him, but that they could either stay at the party that they were at or they could walk to a bar across the street. And according to McKenna, this really ticked Peter off. And instead of just accepting the fact that she was saying no, he kept bugging her, he kept pushing her to go for a ride with him. But he was going beyond like just being annoying and bugging her. He was being really irate and really mean and aggressive. The more she told him no, the more angry and aggressive he was getting.
That's really scary.
Very scary. So eventually she agreed to get in the car with him, and she said later that she was hoping that doing this would help calm him down, just make him happy. But that is not what happened. So after McKenna got in the car with Peter, he got even more belligerent. And at some point, he decided that McKenna must have been up to no good, and he started demanding that she unlock her cell phone and give it to him so that he could look through it. He was convinced that maybe she had been talking to another guy, or that she was doing something behind his back. And so he was insistent upon getting her phone and being able to see what she'd been doing. He just kept doing this and just kept getting more and more aggressive and acting really jealous. And she refused to let him have her phone. So he started slapping her and punching her while he's driving.
Oh my gosh.
So he is in the driver's seat driving while he's beating her up.
Oh my goodness.
So the whole left side of her head, her face, her neck, all is getting hit by him, and he's driving really erratically. It's amazing they didn't crash, honestly.
Yeah.
And this is the middle of the night. This is like, you know, 3, 4 a.m. So after beating her up in this manner, he demanded that she show him some affection. And I don't know exactly what he was wanting to do, but I do know that he threatened to break her hand and break the bones in her fingers if she didn't hold his hand. So I'm assuming maybe like he grabbed her hand and maybe she tried to pull it away and he like squeezed really hard and, yeah, you know, threatened to break her hand. He also bit her on her hand. So again, I can like see this playing out in my mind. I can see like her trying to get away and he's just being just mean, just,
yeah,
and abusive. And again, he's still driving and he's driving away from the well-lit areas in town towards like dark and deserted areas. So she's really freaking out because who knows what he's going to take her to go do. So she starts trying to open the car doors, and every time she unlocks a car door, he locks it back. He will not let her get out. And she's so desperate that presumably she's like ready to jump out of a moving car. That's how desperate she is to get away from him. But he wouldn't let her. He just kept locking the back and holding on to her. The whole time she's just begging him to let her go. He ended up eventually taking her back to his house, and who knows what he had planned for her there. During this time, she's got her cell phone. For whatever reason, she was using Facebook Messenger to try to get her sister and tell her sister what was going on. So I don't know if she was doing it because maybe her sister didn't have access to a phone, or maybe she didn't want him knowing she was making a phone call. Maybe she was trying to be discreet. We really don't know. But she's using Facebook Messenger to try to get help from her sister when Peter grabs her phone out of her hand and throws it. Then he wrapped a cell phone charger cord around his hands and like snapped it in a really threatening way and told McKenna that if she ran away, he would catch her and kill her with the cord. He would choke her with the cord.
Oh my God.
So obviously she knows she's in real trouble. Regardless of whether this is a first date, that's scary, or somebody that you've been with for years, you know, if it's someone she's been with for years, I'm assuming she's probably seen some pretty scary things from him before. Mm-hmm. And if it's a first date, well, that's terrifying on its own, right?
Yeah.
Either way, she's terrified. So she runs, and she runs towards a house she sees with lights on. She found a place to hide, and she stayed there until Peter gave up looking for her and drove away. And then she ran out into the road. She flagged down a car that was passing by, and this driver, a stranger, took her to the local police station where she filed a report. The police officer taking the report said she had redness, obvious redness and swelling on the left side of her face and her body. She had a deep bite mark on her left hand. So he really did beat her up. Obviously, the police do an investigation. Peter was arrested, actually for a separate, unrelated incident where he was held in bail. But charges were filed against him for his attack on McKenna. And these charges were kidnapping, aggravated assault with intent to commit a felony, criminal mischief, battery, and reckless driving. So that was February 10th, 2018. He was released March 3rd, 2018, and his trial, you know, was scheduled in the future. Less than 3 weeks later, on March 24th, he was arrested again for violating his pretrial release conditions. And what this means is that whatever conditions it was the judge ordered for him to follow while he was waiting on his trial date, he violated them. And in the meantime, the state attorney's office ended up changing some of his original charges. They changed that kidnapping charge to false imprisonment and just changed little things. And probably this happened because after talking to McKenna, they realized, okay, it's more of a false imprisonment as opposed to kidnapping type of scenario. He was arrested on March 24th for that violation and then released again on June 1st. A month later, on July 5th, he's arrested again for violation again.
Holy cow.
Yeah. And he was released on September 10th. 3 months later, December 6th, he's arrested again for violating. And this time, he resisted arrest. We don't know exactly what that means, but when they went to arrest him, he resisted. He ran, something like that. But it was without violence this time. He was released on December 12th. 2 weeks later, he was arrested again for, can you guess, violation of probation?
Oh my gosh.
And aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, fleeing and eluding, which means he ran from the police officers, and not having a driver's license. This time, he was arrested in April the following year. He was then sent to state prison.
I don't understand why they keep releasing him, especially with that much history behind him.
Well, and what this goes to show us is that he doesn't care and he doesn't have respect. Like, if you are released, anybody who's released has a list of things they are and are not allowed to do. And if you do them, you're going to get arrested and you're going to just make things worse for yourself. And most people who realize maybe they made a mistake initially and they just want to get back on the right path, fix their life, they're not going to continue to make these bad choices. And he does over and over and over again. So it just goes to show the kind of person he was, that he just didn't care.
Yeah. I'm just saying, I wonder why they keep releasing him. You think after, you know, three times, nope, buddy, you're not going anywhere.
You would think, right?
You would think.
In July 2019, he was finally sentenced to prison for the charges against McKenna. He served for 2 years and 5 months. And he was released on September 4th, 2020. So September 4th, 2020, he gets out of prison. 2 months later, on November 21st, 2020, my husband was at work. It was the Saturday before Thanksgiving. My oldest son was on Thanksgiving break, and he was spending a few days with my parents. And so I decided to do something fun with my two little boys, who were 4 years old and 1 year old. So I took them to the zoo, and we had a great day. I took lots of photos of them playing. I sent my husband videos of the boys being cute and of the animals. It was just a great day. I remember it. I remember it just being such a great day. After lunch, the kids were starting to get tired and cranky, so we left, and they both fell asleep in the car on the way home. So I get home, I pull into my driveway, it's about 3 o'clock, and I decide to just appreciate the fact that both of my kids were asleep in the back seat and it was quiet. So I literally just sat in my car, looking on Facebook or who knows what, for about an hour while the kids slept in the back seat. And at about 4 o'clock, my phone rang, and it was my husband. And it is not unusual for me to hear from my husband during the day. He'll text me all day long. But it is unusual for him to call me. He always calls me when he leaves work. But this was about an hour and a half too early for that. I remember thinking like, oh, that's weird. I wonder what's going on. So I answer the phone and all I hear is a man who is not my husband say, Cynthia. And the way he said it, I immediately knew something really bad was happening. And the first thought in my mind was, he's dead. And the voice on the other end says, it's Chris. And I know Chris, but in that moment, my brain wasn't working. And I didn't put two and two together who it was. You know, I had no idea who I was talking to. And part of that is because, you know, when Andy comes home and talks about someone, he uses last names. So he'd be like, oh yeah, Smith did this and Reeves did this. And so it took me several seconds to figure out who I was even talking to. But the voice said, it's Chris. He's okay. But Andy was shot. The second thought that went through my mind after, oh my gosh, he's dead, was, oh my gosh, we just had a huge fight.
Aw.
Because we had just had a huge fight just the week before. Probably the biggest argument we'd ever had. And you don't want your husband to die a week after you had that huge argument.
No.
All I could think about was, we just had that huge argument. And now this is what happened. I'm going to have to live with this my whole life. That was the second thought in my head. As I'm processing all this, he's telling me what happened. And of course, I retained none of that information because I'm just in complete shock. And when I finally realized what he was saying, I said, is he going to be okay? And he said, yes, he was shot. The bullet's still in there, which I know means, okay, they're going to have to take him to surgery.
Right.
We found out later that was not the case. The bullet had gone through and through. But at the moment, I believed the bullet was still inside. And all I could think is, I have an hour and a half drive to get to the hospital. What if he dies before I get there? So I made him promise me he was going to be okay. And he assured me he was going to be okay. It was not life-threatening. He was going to be fine. So I believed him, but still in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, we don't know what's going to happen once he gets into surgery. We just don't know. So I get off the phone with him, and thank God I had just sat in my driveway with these kids, because otherwise I would have had to pack the kids up and strap them in. Because I had let them just sit in the car and sleep, all I had to do was back into my driveway.
Yeah.
That was really convenient. So I know I need to get to the hospital. I know I don't want to take these kids with me. The climate of COVID, so they really shouldn't have been at the hospital in the first place. But let alone, I don't know what is going to be waiting for me when I get there. So I don't want to have my one-year-old and my four-year-old. So I need to get to my parents to drop these kids off. And I need to call Andy's mom, who lives 10 minutes from us, to let her know, does she want to take the kids or does she want to come with me to the hospital? And I can't even go anywhere until I know which direction I'm heading. Am I picking my mother-in-law up? Am I going to my parents? You know, what am I doing? So I call his mom. And if you've never had to call your husband's mom to tell her that her baby has been shot, that's an experience. She decided she wanted to go to the hospital with me. Then I had to call my parents to get the kids to them. My mom, of course, didn't answer. So then my dad is about to go preach a sermon. It's an hour before church. He did answer, and we got a hold of my mom. She took the kids. Of course, the police department had offered to have somebody come pick me up. But in my mind, I'm just thinking, I just have to get there. That's just going to take more time. Finally, I get my mother-in-law, drop the kids off with my mom, and we're on our way to the hospital. And it's at this point I realize I have no idea what's going on. These people had used my husband's phone to call me, and we don't know how to reach each other. You know, anything could be happening. So I call dispatch, and I'm trying to hey, I'm Andy's wife. Can you tell me what's going on? They can't tell you anything because it's an open investigation. They couldn't tell me anything.
Oh.
So that was this is where the living so far away from the department is. It took me 2 hours to get to the hospital. So 2 hours from the moment I found out my husband was shot is how long it took me to get to him. And I, of course, didn't believe that he was really going to be okay until I walked into the hospital room. He was awake. I saw him. He was real grumpy because he was mad because somebody'd shot him. They were trying to get him to get up and walk, and he couldn't. And that was the first time I was able to just let out a sigh of relief. What had happened? This guy, Peter, he had been seen leaving a known drug house. And again, he just got out of prison 3 months earlier. An officer from a neighboring community, it wasn't even my husband's department, tried pulling him over. And of course, he did what he tends to do. He fled. They chased him. And he crossed, you know, the city lines. And now he's got lots of people chasing him. One officer threw out stop sticks. He tried to run that officer over.
Oh, my gosh. Because,
I mean, this guy was, he was a bad, bad guy. Eventually, he ends up crashing the car at a U-Haul storage facility. He gets out of the car, and he goes running. And all of this, of course, is caught on body cam footage. Good. And the sheriffs have released it. So I was able to watch this. And he's hiding, and he gets surrounded, but the officers don't know exactly where he is. And that is when he shot my husband. And fortunately, one of his shots missed my husband's head by about a foot. And then the second shot, the one that hit him in the leg. And amazingly missed major arteries, genitals, bone, all these important things by like inches. And if you have to be shot, it was like best case scenario. So fortunately, it was not a life-threatening injury because of how it, you know, how it hit him. But while Peter was surrounded, he came running out, charging at the officers with a gun. This is after he shot my husband, and he was shot and killed. And it was horribly sad because at the time he died, he was only 25 years old.
Wow.
He was a father. He had a mother who mourned him. I didn't even know how to feel because in one way, he tried to kill my husband.
Right.
And on another level, he's somebody's little boy who just made a bunch of bad choices. And his history tells me he hadn't learned a lesson.
Right.
He didn't think twice about trying to kill a cop. He would have absolutely hurt anybody he had to get away or achieve whatever he was trying to achieve. It's just a crazy scenario. And so that's why when we're talking about these cases, I feel like I have an advantage on being able to like look at both sides, because I know what it's like to be the wife of someone who has a split second to make a decision. And if they make the wrong one, they may not come home.
Right.
And if they make a different wrong one, well, they may go to prison for hurting somebody who maybe wasn't really a threat. It's a really scary scenario to be in. When I hear these stories of bad police officers, and there are really, really bad police officers, it in some ways is just when you're at one of the good ones, it like hurts so bad because it's like you make us all look bad and you're supposed to be the good guy, and there are good guys, and you're like ruining it for everybody. It's like for me being a pastor's daughter, like whenever a pastor does something really wrong, I'm always like, man, you're making us all look bad, kind of thing. Because
right, you're preaching all this good word, right? Yet you're doing the exact opposite of what you're preaching,
right? And people who are going to look at that and be like, yeah, this is why all pastors are just full of crap, because yeah, you know, they're preaching one thing and they're doing another. And it's the same way with good and bad police officers, because all the ones I know are really, really good people. And my husband comes home and tells me how people treated him. And I'm like, well, you arrested him, didn't you? No, they were just having a bad day.
Oh.
You know, and I was like, you didn't even give him a ticket? They were cussing you out and blah, and you didn't even give him a... No, Cynthia, tickets are expensive. He's the nicest guy. I would be giving you a ticket. I would be taking you to jail. I feel like I can look at things from both sides. I really do. And I will tell you, I was genuinely sad for Peter's family because I can't imagine being in their shoes either.
Right.
Just horrible, horrible scenario. This actually happened a month after we started this podcast. And some of you who've been here from the beginning may remember a couple weeks that we had to take off. And it was because I was dealing with my husband who had just been shot. And I've been really careful for the life of this podcast not to say too much information, not to say what my husband does, because I am very aware that some people will hate him just because he's a police officer. That's part of the reason why I'm being really careful with names and things like that to make it a little harder for you to figure out exactly who he is. At the same time, I'm talking to a bunch of arm sleuth detectives here, so you guys can have this figured out in about 30 seconds if you really want to. But I just thought this is something people might find interesting. This is something that we're all human and we're all affected by people who break the law and hurt other people. And this is just our story. And I will tell you, some good came from it, because I had told you that we were, you know, we'd had a pretty bad fight. We were kind of in that phase. And I think anybody who's been in a long-term relationship knows that sometimes you go through seasons where, like, you don't appreciate each other so much. Maybe you find each other a little more annoying than you normally do. And we were kind of in that phase. And this was, like, such a good reminder that, like, don't take each other for granted. We're really, really lucky to have each other. And it was, like, a good moment in our marriage.
Yeah, you know? Good reminder.
Good reminder.
Like, it's unfortunate that it had to be that an extreme of a reminder.
Well, you know, I'm a little thick-headed, so it takes some extreme reminders for me sometimes. But, you know. So that is the survival story of my husband, Andy, who I'm just so thankful is here.
That's incredible.
He's incredible, but yeah, it's still hard to believe. I remember that night in the hospital. Okay, so he's in the hospital. He's kept there. We're watching them talking about him on the news from, you know, the hospital.
Oh my gosh, yeah. That must have been surreal.
It was so weird. The nurses are coming in saying, like, oh, I was just reading a story about you, or I was just talking to, you know, I just heard the mayor talk. The mayor came to the hospital.
Wow.
The chief of police came to the hospital. The chief of police from the neighboring town came to the hospital.
Wow.
A lot of the department came to the hospital. Like, it was really, it was surreal. And after that night, like in the middle of the night, it takes hours to, like, figure all this out. You know, the officers were on scene all night cleaning up this mess, yeah, because mm-hmm. of everything that, processing everything. The officers who shot at Peter, anyone who pulled their trigger, was immediately placed on paid leave, administrative leave, which is just standard, because my husband's attorney for the police department came to him and said, I'm your attorney. I'm going to be representing you in this homicide investigation. You are now the subject of a homicide investigation because Peter had been killed.
Right.
And my husband had pulled the trigger. So that's freaky all in and of itself to be told. That's
going to be a weird sentence to hear.
Yeah. And he even said, we've watched all the body cam footage. Nobody did anything wrong. The only person who did anything wrong was Peter. You will not be in any trouble, but you do need to know that you are the subject of a homicide investigation. You will be questioned. The state will have to clear you. And that's stressful.
Heck yeah.
So stressful. And this is something that made me cry. The reason why my husband called me, that's not standard. They wouldn't normally call you. And I should have known that he wasn't dead, because if he had been, they wouldn't have called me. They would have, you know,
come to your door.
Come to my door. But the reason why he called me is when this happened, he was lucid. He was awake. And as they're, like, ripping his clothes off, he says, get my phone. Somebody's got to call Cynthia. I don't want Cynthia to see this on the news. I don't want her to be worried. Somebody's got to call Cynthia. And his attorney said, I have to tell you, I have never had a guy, you know, where the first thing he's saying is, somebody needs to call my wife. And he said, and that speaks to how this man thinks about you.
Yes, it does.
And I was like, oh my gosh. Like,
he really loves me.
He really does like me. Yeah, it was crazy. The whole thing was just crazy. But I remember after everybody left that night, neither one of us got any sleep. And it wasn't because we were exhausted, because we were exhausted. But it was just like, did that really just happen? Did you really just get shot? Because it's that moment that anyone in law enforcement, you never want to come. It's that call you never want to come. And it came. It was just insane.
That is insane.
Yeah. And we're all better for it. So that is the survival story of my husband, Andy.
Wow. That's incredible.
So, Paula, do you have a time to kill?
I do. And this one is really creepy and kind of gross.
Oh, okay. Good.
So, have you ever heard of the Key West Corpse Bride?
No.
Okay. Well, I was looking at weird, creepy stuff in Florida.
Okay.
And I found something. So this guy, Carl Tanzler, who was born in 1877, grew up in Imperial Germany. There's not a lot of info on his childhood, other than he had a sister, and his hobbies were astronomy, science, and building and inventing things. He did quite a bit of traveling. He visited Cuba, Australia, India, and in 1926, he went to Zephyr Hills, Florida, to visit his sister. He decided to settle down. He was eventually joined by his wife and two daughters. After one of his daughters died from a throat infection, Tanzler found work in a marine hospital in Key West. This is where he met Maria Elena Milagros de Hoyos. Maria, a Cuban-American performer, had been married since age 16.
That's kind of sad.
This is back in, like, you know.
Yeah.
A long time ago.
When that's what women were good for.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, once you're 16, you got to get married and have kids.
That's right.
Yikes. After her miscarriage, her husband left her and moved to Miami. Maria, now 19, was diagnosed with tuberculosis. She was actually at death's door. For some reason, Tanzler had his name changed and was now going by Count Carl Van Kossel. That's a mouthful.
I like it, though.
I like that he's a count.
Can I be a countess?
Right? So, despite having any medical training, he was working as a bacteriologist and radiologist. He claimed he could be the one to treat Maria. He gave her homemade tonics and herbs, because in my normal brain, that's how I say it. So even though I wrote it, and I know you're supposed to say herbs.
You say herbs.
I say herbs.
Okay.
Sue me. Homemade tonics and herbs, and an x-ray machine that he stole from the hospital. He also brought her jewelry, clothing, and asked her to marry him over and over. Maria said no over and over, possibly because she was sick and dying, and technically she was still married. Maria died October 25th, 1931, in her parents' home in Key West. The broken-hearted count would visit her grave every night. In April of 1933, the count dug up Maria, carried her to his home in a toy wagon. He claimed her spirit told him to rescue her from this stone prison, and she finally agreed to marry him. He, finger quote, restored her body, and for 7 years slept next to her corpse.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, I told you it was gross. It was much more than just sleeping next to her. He bought her perfume, clothes, and cared for her as though she were still alive. A neighbor of the count said he could see him dancing with what looked like a life-size doll. Word spread all over the town, and Maria's sister, suspicious, went to the count's home. She discovered her dead sister's body, which that's awful just by itself.
Oh, yeah.
So she called the police, and the count was arrested. But, get this, the statute of limitations had expired on his crimes, and he was let go.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. The story became very well known. The count's name was always in the press. The story was so popular that Maria's body was put on display at Dean Lopez's funeral home. I know, that's crazy. It gets worse. People came from all over. Approximately 6,800 people came to look at her body, and they were selling tickets for $1 apiece.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. But eventually, Maria was reburied in an unmarked grave so she could finally rest in peace. The count left Key West and went home, back to Zephyr Hills, living close to his wife and daughter. He died in July of 1952, supposedly holding on to a death mask he made of Maria's face. He was also buried in an unmarked grave, out of fear of people messing with it, defacing it. Later, it was revealed by physicians at the initial autopsy that the count was having sex with Maria's corpse.
Of course he was. He was dancing with her and sleeping with her every night.
Yeah, buying her perfume and clothing. Oh, so he's changing her clothes if he's buying clothing.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. How did he preserve her body for 7 years?
I don't know.
Especially in Florida.
Where it's humid.
Yeah, and back Key then West they didn't. It's even they more so.
They didn't have air conditioning back then.
Yeah. I mean, she would have been a hot mess. Literally.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, it said that science was one of his hobbies.
Okay.
So I think maybe he
figured out some way to do something.
I'm trying not to say pickled, but that's the only thing in my brain. He pickled her.
It's been long enough that we can laugh about
it. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's insane.
Yeah.
Oh no. Okay, so when you talked about the whole charging tickets to see the body, do you remember that exhibit that would go to like science museums? It was called Bodies, and it was like real live bodies that have been preserved.
Yeah.
Did you ever go to it?
No.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
I think it's really interesting, and I love science, but that's not something I could look at.
Oh, Paula. I went one time. I found myself with a couple hours to spare, and I was on iDrive right next to where they had this exhibit, and I went. I couldn't eat the rest of the day. And the thing is, it wasn't gory in any way, shape, or form. It's actually really well done and really fascinating. But it's also really gross to, like, look at a body and, like, just know that
it was once a living person walking around.
Yeah. And it was pretty gross. I remember they had one section that was babies and fetuses. And you had to, like, there was a big sign that said sensitive material on the other side. Don't go if you don't want to see.
Mm-hmm.
And they had, and this was actually really fascinating, because they had fetuses at different points of development. And it was like, oh, wow.
That's what it looks like.
Yeah, that's really incredible. And then, of course, the most sad one was, like, you know, a stillbirth. So that one was pretty, you know, upsetting.
Yeah.
The rest of them, you know, was a little more, I don't know, to me that's a little more easier to look at just because it doesn't seem real, even though it is.
Right.
It was just really interesting. I just remember that. But I also was really grossed out about it.
Oh, yeah. I would be, too.
All right, speaking of gross and dead bodies, thank you so much for recommending Yellow Jackets.
You are welcome.
Oh my gosh. My husband and I watched the first episode, but I was like, I have no idea what we just watched. Let's watch one more. I just need to know. We binge watched that show. We stopped. We have several other shows that we like to watch. We stopped them all so we could watch the entire season of Yellow Jackets. At the end of every episode, it was like, I literally have no idea what I just watched. And I love it. It was so good. So good. Christina Ricci.
Oh.
I loved her before. First of all, the whole cast is amazing. Yes. Every single person is stellar. But Christina Ricci, her character is the best. You have to watch it for no other reason than just to see her in all of her glory. And then the actress who plays her as a child is just as freaking good.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. You guys have to watch Yellow Jackets. It's amazing.
It is.
And I kept telling Andy, as we were getting close to the end of the season, I was like, they better answer this question. They better not leave us hanging on this. Thank you for that recommendation. You always have, like, the best recommendation.
I know TV.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you do. It's a gift.
Hey, guys, just a quick word to let you know. From now on, we're going to be releasing our episodes on Monday. So after this episode, look for us on Mondays.
Well, thanks, guys, for listening. Please check out our website for pictures and for links corresponding to each episode at dollsanddoom.com. Follow us on social media and leave us a comment.
And stay alive so you don't end up on the wrong side of the grass. Bye!